MacCast, Sunday, November 20th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. What a long, strange week it's been for me. I think winter is setting in upon us a little bit. It's getting a little bit colder even here in sunny Southern California where I live in San Diego. And I developed a little bit of a cold earlier in the week. You may still hear a little bit of the residuals of that as we dive into the show. But we got a lot of great Mac news and things to talk about, but before we dive into that, I want to take a quick moment, thank one of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. I want to talk about a feature of Notebook that I think is extremely useful, especially if you're a student or somebody who has to take notes at a lecture, something like that, something that I don't use a lot, but is in there, has been in there for a while, and it is really, really helpful, and that is the voice annotation feature. So you can actually turn on a recorder as you're taking notes, and what's cool is within Notebook, as you are going from item to item within, say, an outline that you might be working on, it's throwing in markers, and it has little audio buttons over there in the sidebar, in the margin of the notes that you're taking, and you can come back later and review the audio that was actually playing during your notes. So you could use that, of course, to annotate your own notes, but I think it's extremely helpful if you had your Mac there in class, you could turn on the recorder and maybe be able to review something a professor or teacher or lecturer was maybe running through. I guess this would be great for conferences too. Very often I'm at a conference and I wish I could go back and get and hear that audio, especially in context with the notes that I was taking. Because sometimes you'll write down a note and maybe you didn't quite hear something or you made a quick notation and it doesn't quite make sense to you, it's good to be able to go back and hear the original audio that was attached with that. And you can do that right within Notebook. And then you can come back later and, of course, highlight things and mark things, add in little notes and additional bits of information, maybe put some stickies and tabs and start to organize your thoughts and ideas and stuff in a way that makes a little more sense, and maybe add in some additional information that you might find from a web clipping, stuff like that. And that is the true power of Notebook, just its flexibility, the number of things that you can do with it, and then sort of bring everything together under sort of one notebook. And it's a really great application. They've been working on it for a really long time. They continue to evolve and improve it with every new iteration. And so if you haven't taken a moment to take a look at it, please head over to circusponies.com. They have free trials available. There's some great video tutorials on how to get up and running with the product very, very quickly. They make it quick and easy, which is just how all Mac Apple stuff should be, right? So check it out, circusponies.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So as I was mentioning, we've got a lot of great news stories to get into. The first one I want to talk about today is some more evidence that iOS may be getting some additional messaging features. This came about because a developer, John Heaton, found some code strings in the latest version of iOS that shows potential support for some messaging services that aren't currently supported within Apple's applications on iOS devices. In addition to the iMessage and the FaceTime references, which you'd expect to be there, he also found some references to the Jabber and AIM AOL instant messaging services. Both of these are currently supported in iChat on the desktop, but haven't really made their way into Apple's messaging app on iOS. Now, some of the rumors that I've been reading are suggesting that iChat, an iChat app, may show up on iOS sometime soon. I'm a little bit more hopeful than that. I think I've mentioned this before. I'm hoping that Apple plans to unify all of their messaging on iOS under a single application. With them adding iMessage to the Messages app in iOS, that's a first step, I think, because it enables different iOS devices to communicate under a single protocol within a single application. So whether you're doing SMS, text messages, or you're doing iMessages, they're all in one place. It's seamless and easy. I think Apple has made that process incredibly Apple-like in terms of if I send an SMS message to my wife on her iPhone, it immediately flips over. I don't have to think about it. It just becomes an iMessage, and I'm not paying additional messaging charges. It'd be great if I'd be able to have that same kind of messaging to my friends and family, people who are on Macs, through, makes the most sense to me, the iChat application, or more probably correct would be to merge iChat and the Messages app into one thing. Just have Messages on Mac OS X and Messages on iOS, and they handle all the different formats and protocols, at least for text messaging. I could see them keeping maybe video under the FaceTime moniker, but I even think that merging FaceTime into a messaging app, having it be a complete solution, kind of like Skype, but better, in my opinion, I think that's the way they're going. And that's what I'm hoping when we see these little references to some of the other services that Apple is thinking about, sort of unifying, having Messages on iOS and Mac OS X. And we'll just have to wait and see what they do. I really don't sort of relish the idea of having some other app like iChat on my iOS device. I'd like to just to be all in one place. So at the very least, we can see some references to some things that they might be working on this week with this rumor. Final Cut 10 was updated this past week to 10.0.2. It appears to be a release to deal with some minor bugs in the application. No major new features or enhancements there. Fixes an issue where a title may revert to the original default font after restarting Final Cut Pro 10. Also resolved an issue that would cause files recorded in certain third-party mobile devices to play back incorrectly, and also addressed a stability issue caused by changing the start time on a compound clip. So if you're a Final Cut 10 user, you probably want to grab that update. I know many people are hoping for Apple to enhance and bring back some of the features that were lost in Final Cut when they made the move, from Final Cut 7 to Final Cut 10. Apple continues to work on the product, but this time around, it looks like it's simply a bug release fix update that you're going to want to grab. Some good news this week for Apple and the Mac. It looks like their market share continues to rise, actually finally cracking the 5% mark in worldwide PC sales, at least according to Needham & Company analyst Charlie Wolf. I ran across this piece over at Macworld. It's actually been 15 years since Apple has had this much global market share. So this is pretty significant, pretty big news story this week. It's actually amazing because Apple has, their sales have outpaced the rest of the PC industry average for the past 22 consecutive quarters. So it shouldn't be that surprising that they've cracked this mark. It's taken them a while to get there. By Wolf's estimates, Apple sold about 4.89 million Macs in the September quarter. That's more Macs in one quarter than in any entire year prior to 2006. So Apple is just blowing away the market in terms of their actual sales numbers. Apple's growth in the enterprise is even bigger. He kind of broke things out in his report, and hit by Wolf's estimates, Apple is up 43.8% in the enterprise market. I imagine a large part of that is due to the fact that we're getting some of this iOS halo effect. So you have business customers, at least at home in their consumer life, buying iPhones, buying iPads, and they want to bring those into work. We've been hearing about this for a while. That seems to be making an impact and sort of cracking the enterprise market. More and more companies are actually looking at Macs as an option to have in their businesses. And I have a feeling it's because their end users are demanding that they want to have Macs. And a lot of CEOs and presidents and stuff like that are starting to get iPhones and realizing they want that same kind of experience in the enterprise. And I think it's making a big deal. There was another study this week from research firm iPass that seems to be indicating that the iPhone, I guess on a similar note, has passed BlackBerry in the business smartphone segment, rising in its share to about 45% in 2011, up from 31.1% in 2010. BlackBerry shares actually fell slightly in the same period, from 34.5% down to 32.2%, according to the iPass numbers. Android is also, of course, on the rise. They had an impressive increase in the business market, up 10% from 11.3% to 21.3% in 2011. So Apple and Android both rising in the business cell phone market, while BlackBerry continues to drop slightly. Nielsen this past week took a survey of what kids want for the holidays, and topping their wish lists are a bunch of Apple products. They surveyed 3,000 U.S. kids, and guess what they wanted for the holidays? They wanted iPads, iPod Touches, and iPhones. In that order, Apple took the top three spots with children between the ages of 6 and 12. As a matter of fact, 44% said that they wanted iPads, 30% iPods, and 27% iPhones. The next three products in order were computers, non-iPad tablets, and the Nintendo 3DS at 25% each. When it came to kids 13 and older, it was a little bit different. The iPad was still desired by 24%. But computers and ebook readers were at 18% and television sets at 17%. The iPhone was the next Apple product desired by teens, coming in at 7th place with the 13 and older set at 15%, and the iPod Touch was 12th at 8%. Obviously, in looking at the percentages, kids were allowed to pick more than one item on the list. For teens, I wonder if Apple scored lower mainly because many of them probably already have iOS devices like iPhones, iPods, or iPads. No matter what, I have a feeling that Apple stores will be doing a brisk business this holiday season, and I think that Apple's first quarter numbers are likely to reflect that. And sort of as was to be expected, now that the iPhone 4S is out, it's time to move on to the next round of rumors, which are mostly going to be around the iPad, also future Mac products. More on that in a minute. But DigiTimes reported that Apple had reduced the number of iPad 2 display orders as it begins to ramp up its iPad 3 production. Apple has apparently stockpiled components in the third quarter so that they would have a healthy stock of inventory to carry them through the end of the year for producing iPads, of course, for that heavy holiday season that I would expect they'll have. This would also explain why there was this recent rash of reports, I think DigiTimes sourced from that one as well, that Apple had cut its fourth quarter iPad production. They actually weren't cutting production. What the rumors were alluding to was the fact that Apple had scaled back on its component part orders for the iPad 2, and many suspect that that is so that they can start ramping up iPad 3 production in the early first quarter, probably end of fourth quarter. There is a returning rumor that the iPad 3 will feature a high pixel density Retina display. LG, Samsung, and Sharp are all rumored to be supplying displays for the next generation iPad, and reportedly they shipped 1 million units in October and will ship 2 million display parts in November. Suppliers are reportedly having trouble, though, producing the high-density displays in volume. There's been some debate online about the display density and resolution. Doubling up on the current iPad 1024 by 768 resolution would bring the resolution to 2048 by 1156. And if they keep the 9.7-inch display size, that would make sense because it would allow developers to more easily scale up their apps for the new higher resolution iPad. The trouble is that at that resolution, the pixel density becomes only about 260 pixels per inch. Unofficially, Retina is believed to be a display density of about 300 pixels per inch, and actually on the current generation iPhones, it's 326 ppi. I'm not 100% certain that Apple really came out and defined an actual pixel density. I seem to remember what they said was that it was a display resolution where the pixel density was high enough that individual pixels were not discernible from a normal viewing distance. On the iPhone, many believe that to be about 12 inches. So on an iPad, you could technically argue that the distance, the average viewing distance would be a little bit further. So you probably could argue that on an iPad, 260 pixels per inch could still be considered a Retina resolution. If you want to go the other way, to achieve a 300 pixel per inch density on a 9.7 inch screen, that resolution would have to be 2560 by 1920, quite a bit more pixels than on the current display. And this would mean that there would be a third display resolution that developers would have to optimize the interface for their apps on. So I've been kind of thinking about this resolution and thought, well, maybe the way they could sell that to developers would be to have a similar sized or maybe half the size display for a new iPhone 5, a higher resolution iPhone 5. That would be a 1280 by 960 resolution. And if you put that on a 4-inch display, that would give you about a 400 pixel per inch pixel density on the LCD. I don't think that's likely anytime soon. I was doing some research and Samsung had a roadmap that they put out in 2011, April of 2011, I believe, and it showed that they could achieve a 400 pixel per inch, 10.1 inch display, but they wouldn't reach that density until about 2015, and that's on a much larger panel. I have a feeling from a technical standpoint, it'd be hard to cram that much pixel density into a small resolution display. I also think it would negatively impact battery life because you'd need more of a GPU to actually drive that kind of resolution. So in looking at all the evidence, I think it makes the most sense for Apple to just double the resolution of the current display, go with the 2048 by 1536 display resolution. That would give them the 260 pixel per inch density. I think that's going to be enough to qualify as Retina for an iPad, but I think it's also going to be tricky for suppliers to even supply a resolution of that high quality. Reportedly, backlighting would also be an issue on a higher resolution display, and some reports have said that the iPad 2 may have dual LED light bars to even out the color and backlighting on those displays, and that might require that the next generation iPad is actually slightly thicker at about 0.7 millimeters in thickness. As far as when we will see an iPad 3, the iPad 3 is predicted to be shipping around March of 2012, which would be on that kind of yearly release schedule. So I tend to think that that makes a lot of sense. And as far as other features, we're not hearing too much just yet. Display has been kind of the focus of all the latest rumors. Of course, we also have rumors that Apple is developing a smaller version of the iPad, a 7.85 inch tablet display is reportedly being tested by Apple with the help of AU Optoelectronics and LG Display. That rumor, if you ask me, I think is ridiculous. I think Apple has said multiple times that they don't think that a tweener-style tablet is something that anybody wants. Many feel that Apple needs to bring out a smaller tablet to respond to the recent release of the Kindle Fire. For my part, I think they're not even in the same league. I think it's a totally different product. It's at the lower end of the display market, and I think Apple doesn't want to play around in the low-end game. Lower quality display, lower quality digitizer, and I think some of that information is coming out in the early reviews of the Kindle, where it's being noted the performance isn't quite up to snuff of the iPad. Frankly, I don't even think the two should be compared, but it's going to be very hard for reviewers not to make a comparison since the iPad has been out for a few years now and has been the dominating tablet so far. And I guess there is, in a way, a rumor about another feature that might show up in the next generation iPad and iPhone, for that matter, because Qualcomm is now shipping its 4G LTE Gobi 4000 platform chips to OEMs. This could be the chip that powers the first generation of 4G iPhones and iPads. For those of you who don't know, the Gobi platform combines 3G and 4G modems into a single chipset and also allows that device to support LTE HSPA Plus and LTE EVDO networks, LTE being the next generation 4G mobile platform that most of the carriers are going with. Apple currently uses Gobi technology in its Verizon CDMA iPhone 4 and iPad 2, although the GSM parts of those chipsets are disabled, I believe. The 4S has a different chipset in it. So 4G is likely a next-generation feature of the next iPhone. The iPhone 5, it's being rumored, is expected to come out as early as this summer. I think that might be a little bit early given the late release of the iPhone 4S. But if it does, it's sounding like it's going to lose the teardrop design that was rumored earlier this year. If you remember, many people were expecting a slight change in the design of the iPhone and that it would look a little bit more like a MacBook Air in terms of the profile. It's still reportedly going to have the metal back like the current generation iPads. There's that rumor that it will get a 4-inch screen being supplied by LG. Personally, I'm taking all of these rumors with a grain of salt, maybe even a little bit more than that. I think some of them are a bit ridiculous. Many of them are being sourced to a post by the Korea Times website, and that post was actually pulled not long after the rumor sites started picking them up. The reason I'm calling a little bit of fakety-fake, to use Jeff Gamet's term on that, I'm doing that because I think that Apple is not going to go with a larger screen. I think the current size and form factor of the iPhone, maybe if they can scale it up and keep the actual size of the device about the same, we could end up with a 4-inch display, but I don't see any reason really to move it up. I've, you know, held some of those 4.5, 4.7-inch Android phones, and to me, they're getting a little bit horsey. I think Apple's not going to want to muck up the design like that. Also, I don't think that they're going to want to put a new iPhone out this summer. I don't see a really big, compelling reason to do that. We'll have to see how iPhone 4S sales are going by that time. If sales have started to slow down around the summertime, I could see Apple potentially releasing an iPhone 5 back on the kind of schedule they were on prior to this year. But I have a feeling the iPhone is now due for more of a fall launch time frame or end of summer launch time frame. And let's finish up the news for this week with a Mac rumor. I'm happy to be able to be reporting on some Mac rumors now. 9to5 Mac says that they have reliable sources who said that Apple had planned a 15-inch MacBook Air when it announced the 11-inch and 13-inch models back in 2010. Supposedly, the prototype units are still floating around at the Cupertino campus, and those that have them like them, despite the fact that they had a slight issue with them that caused them to be scrapped. They were scrapped reportedly at the last minute because the hinges couldn't reliably hold the larger screens and bezels. Apple needed to actually completely redesign the hinge mechanism for the 15-inch model, so they decided not to launch it. The good news is that while they decided not to put it out then, they have been working on a new design, and supposedly now when they come out with it, it will feature a 22-nanometer Ivy Bridge Intel processor. It would be faster, offer better onboard graphics, and have better battery life than the prior model. It's expected that the 15-inch ultra-thin MacBook Air, maybe a MacBook Pro, would come out sometime in early 2012. And that's actually a point of debate, I think, is would it be put out as a MacBook Air, or are they going to sort of revamp the entire Pro line to be a little bit more Air-like? Is Air defined by the actual size of the device, being 11-inch, 13-inch, or is it actually having more to do with the internal components being SSD and super thin and all that sort of thing? I really don't know. I have a feeling that the MacBook Air models are sort of the future of the way that Apple wants to take their notebook lineup, and whether or not there'll be a rebranding or a renaming of the line remains to be seen. But we should know come early 2012 whether or not we're getting a 15-inch model. I think that'd be actually pretty cool. You know, the 11 and 13-inch are some pretty smoking Mac machines, and having a little bit larger screen, I think for some people, is kind of a critical part of having a notebook. So that's it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment, thank another one of our show sponsors, Smile. I want to talk today a little bit more about PDF Pen Pro. I've talked about it in the past. Let me point out a couple really cool features that you get with the Pro version. Well, actually, one really cool feature you get with the Pro version. It has the ability to convert websites, entire URLs, into multi-page PDFs, complete with hyperlinks. This is really great if you have a site that maybe you want to scrape down and do a little bit of off-site browsing. You can turn that right into a PDF with PDF Pen Pro. Some other features that are built into both PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro, the ability to redact or erase text within a PDF. And what's great about how it's implemented by Smile is that it also removes any of the OCR or underlying search text. You'll find some programs out there that really only go and black out or put a black mark through the text within the PDF, but the underlying text is still searchable, which really isn't redacting or removing the text from the document. You also have the ability to OCR scanned documents, so anything you scan in, you can have PDF Pen OCR for you, making it completely searchable. It has the ability to easily add signatures or text to existing PDFs. This is the feature that I use most, the ability to add and fill out PDF forms and then add my signature and send them back, really allowing me to go completely paperless with my documents. No more do I have to print something out, sign it, rescan it back in just to send it back in an email. I can do that all right within the PDF, from within PDF Pen. And they even have a great snippet library for common scribbles, signatures, and other drawing elements. You can put those into a library right within the app and add them back into your documents quickly and easily through that. It even has a built-in proofreader's marks library. So if you're a teacher, an educator, somebody who has to mark up a lot of documents, you can do that all without having to pull out your pen right within the application. They have free trials available, so you can check it all out. Head over to smilesoftware.com for more information and details, and a big thank you to Smile for their support of the MacCast. So one of the big things that happened this past week was that Apple finally launched its iTunes Match service. That was supposed to be out at the end of October. They were a little bit delayed on that launch, but it's out. You can now, for $25 a year, sign up for iTunes Match, and that gives you the ability to move all of your music, your iTunes music, or most of your iTunes music into the cloud. I did an in-depth review and analysis on the MacCast members show, so if you are a member, you can listen to that, or you may consider signing up to take a listen. You can find information and details on how to do that at member.maccast.com. But I also wanted to just talk a little bit about it here and give you some of my initial thoughts and opinions of the service. I have kind of one word for it, and that was clunky. You know, it actually could be my one word for most of Apple's cloud services. You know, Apple's been struggling with actually making stuff work in the cloud. I think they show a little bit of their lack of experience, although you'd think they'd have enough because they've been doing stuff with MobileMe and .Mac for years. It just seems to be one of those areas where Apple really doesn't quite get it. I think they don't quite understand what consumers want. And I guess for me, the thing about iTunes Match and a lot of the cloud services is they just don't have Apple's standard ease of use. They kind of feel a little bit unfinished in areas, and you kind of bump and grind your way through it. And yeah, you can get stuff done, but it's a little bit tricky. You know, that said, I think it's early to kind of judge iTunes Match. Hopefully Apple will continue to work on and improve the service. I have to say the price is right. Certainly very cheap, $25 a year. I think it has enough stuff in it to make it worthwhile for many people. Kind of some of the things that I find a little bit clunky. You know, syncing a base set of songs for me would be really nice. One of the features when you turn on iTunes Match is it disables or turns off any syncing over your USB cable. So you suddenly just don't sync your iPhone or your iOS device to iTunes anymore. It happens all through the cloud. So you turn on the service, it goes through, it scans your library, it tries to match up any tracks that are in your library with stuff that's already in the iTunes store. If it finds a match, it unlocks that in the cloud in your iTunes Match service, and you have access to that music from your Mac and from your iOS devices. And on the iOS devices, you actually download the tracks directly to the device. So there's really no more syncing that goes on. Apple kind of turns off that ability. What I would like the ability to do is sort of define a base set of music so that when I'm out and about using my iOS device and I don't have connection to a network either over Wi-Fi, I have a feeling this would be a bigger issue if I was an iPod Touch owner. But even on the iPhone, there's situations where I might be on a plane, I don't have access to a network, so I can't pull down music. So in those cases, you'd have to remember to kind of download or pre-sync up music before you are able to listen to it. And I've had this weird situation happen where I didn't have a good cell phone connection and I was listening on something like Shuffle and it wasn't able to pull down a song. And so it starts doing almost like a now playing slideshow of my music. It starts to try and play a track that's in the cloud. It doesn't end up downloading and then it just jumps to the next track because it thinks it's already played it. Little weird stuff like that are the kinds of things that I'm talking about as being clunky. And just the ability to say, hey, here's a base playlist, always make sure you sync this to my device, that would be really great. There actually is a workaround for this, kind of a trick. If you sync over a bunch of music before you turn on iTunes Match in iTunes, that music will actually stay on your device. So when you turn iTunes Match on, those tracks will already be preloaded and you won't have to re-download those from the cloud. I also found that upgrading tracks on iTunes was not really clear. It wasn't really obvious how you actually do that. So after it does your music scan, you get a new column in iTunes, and you can actually turn on the iCloud status column in iTunes if you go into the main list and right-click or control-click on the column titles, you'll be able to turn those on or off. I think Command-J is the shortcut for that. But turn on the iCloud status column, and then you can see what's been uploaded and what's available for being upgraded. In terms of what can be upgraded, any tracks that are less than 256 kilobits per second and are things that iCloud has been able to match, you can actually upgrade. The way you have to do that is you delete the track after it's done the scan and done the matching. After that whole process is completed, you can delete a track within iTunes, and then it will be made available for downloading from the iCloud. And when you download from iCloud or from the iTunes Match service, it will pull down the 256 kilobit AAC version of that. So that process isn't really obvious, and if you need to do a large volume of tracks, it seems like you kind of have to do it one at a time, but Jason Snell over at Macworld had a great little tip of making a smart playlist. So pulling a smart playlist that only had your less than 256 kilobit per second tracks and ones that were available for upgrade through iCloud, you build that smart playlist, and then you can go ahead and remove all those from your iTunes library and then batch download or upgrade those tracks. Just be aware of when you do that, you're going to be increasing the size of your iTunes library. And I would recommend making sure you have a backup of all your existing music, because in some cases when I was playing around with this, sometimes the track wouldn't immediately download from iCloud. I don't know if that's some growing pains or some connectivity issues, but just something to be aware of. Another thing to be aware of is when you turn on iTunes Music Match, you have to have Genius turned on. I know some people don't like the Genius feature, but it makes a lot of sense because it does all the matching through using the Genius database within iTunes. So just something else to be aware of. Also, another thing that I found a little bit clunky was that there's no true streaming on iOS. I kind of already alluded to this, to the fact that you actually have to download the tracks on your iOS devices. Now, it does kind of a progressive download, so you'll hit play on a track and it can actually be playing while it's downloading. So it's a little bit of a pseudo streaming, but it is actually storing that track on your device. This could make storage and music management still an issue. A lot of people were thinking that I get iTunes Match and now I can free up a bunch of space on my iOS devices. Well, as you play music, it's going to be continually downloading those tracks onto your iOS device and filling that space back up. Now, luckily, Apple did kind of think about this. I read an article that they're going to be helping with the storage thing. What happens is if your device has filled up and you need to download more tracks, or you're trying to listen to more tracks out of iTunes Music Match, it will actually start deleting older tracks to make space for the newer ones. And it uses kind of a smart algorithm for that. What it does is it deletes not only the oldest tracks, but it also looks at how often those tracks were played and starts with the oldest, least played tracks first, which is kind of a nice feature. But you really don't have a lot of control over that. Of course, you could go through and manually delete tracks off your iOS device. For those of you who don't know how to do that, if you just swipe across the track left to right, you know, sort of draw a line through it, you'll get the little delete button. You can delete tracks right off the device to free up some space. But again, that gets back to this kind of clunky feeling of this manual music management. As far as what I do like about the iTunes Match service, I think cleaning up duplicates seems a lot easier. It goes through and it actually recognizes, after doing the matching process, any duplicate tracks that are in your library and will identify those by giving it a little double cloud icon with a slash through it. And actually, if you turn on that iCloud status column, you'll notice it'll say duplicate in there, so you can quickly and easily clean out any duplicate tracks that are in your library. Upgrading tracks in terms of the quality, in terms of once you figure out how to do it, what you get, that's awesome. One really nice feature is I had a bunch of music that I had purchased prior to Apple going DRM free, so I have a bunch of Fairplay DRM'd tracks. You're actually able to remove those, and then when you re-download the tracks, you get the 256 kilobit AAC DRM free versions. So those iTunes Plus tracks, now you don't have to pay for. They're covered by your $25 a year fee. And that whole process makes anybody who needs to unify multiple libraries or situations where they had purchased music under multiple iTunes accounts a little bit easier, because you can make sure that you're logged into both accounts, do your iTunes match, and then start upgrading your tracks to the DRM-free stuff, and that way you can kind of pull it all over into a single iTunes library under a single iTunes account. And on the iTunes side, on the Mac, the tracks actually do stream. So if you have stuff that's up in the iCloud or up in iCloud in iTunes Match, you don't have to download it. You can actually double-click and start playing it, and it will stream right into iTunes. Why they don't enable the streaming feature on iOS devices is beyond me. The one thing that I can think of is maybe they're doing it to protect users from going over their bandwidth cap limits on the different carriers and things like that. A few other things that I found a little bit clunky are things like this that listener John ran into.
Hi, Adam. I've been looking forward to using iTunes Match since I have a large music collection of 378 gigabits and 33,000 tracks, most of which are ripped legally from CDs I own. Only about several thousand are from the iTunes store. Given the size of my collection, Apple does not make any iPhones, iPads, or iPods that hold that big a collection. I can still use an iPod Classic for my car because that has the biggest hard drive, but even that's not enough. However, when I tried to activate iTunes Match today, I ran into a brick wall because the service is not supported when you have over 25,000 tracks that are not purchased from iTunes. I'd be happy to pay a lot more than $25 that Apple's charging, which of course would be reasonable since I'd be using more storage in the cloud, but Apple doesn't offer that as an option. Moreover, they astonishingly don't allow you to sell a subset of tracks to sync to the cloud, the way you'd select a subset of tracks to sync from iTunes to any of your iOS devices. Any suggestions for how I can work around this restriction by Apple? I do find it frustrating that they seem to abandon me, given that I've purchased about 40 Apple computers, 10 iPhones, 8 iPods, 4 iPads for me and my family since my very first Apple II back in 1980. Love your show, and I've been a MacCast listener and member since the very beginning. Take care.
Okay, thanks, John. I appreciate you being a listener and a member. That's really great. You know, as far as the 25,000 song limit, I've known a couple people have run into this. I'm hoping that this is something that Apple addresses, because I think you're right. I think there's some listeners out there that and users out there who were hoping that this would solve some of their storage problems. And obviously, I don't know if that's a hard limit imposed by the labels or just something Apple kind of defined as being a limit because of performance or whatever reasons. You know, we could sit here and speculate on why they have it, but it does exist, and that really doesn't end up solving your problem, at least in the short term. The only solution that I could think of for someone like you would be to create some sort of sub-library that you would define just to use for iTunes Match. The problem there is you'd kind of have to break up your existing library or iTunes library into smaller components. And you can do that fairly easily. If you hold down the Option key when you launch iTunes, it gives you the option to select a library or create a new one. So what you could do is create a new library, call it your iTunes Match library, and then start loading music into that. Now, I think I read one tip on a Macworld article that I thought was pretty clever. If when you set up that library, you turn off the option to copy the music into your iTunes folder, into the music library folder, you can then start adding in music into that library, and it's really just going to define pointers to where your existing music library is, so you're not going to be doubling up tracks or copying in tracks into the same location. You're really just setting up, hey, this is where my music is. And then for that library, turn iTunes Match on in that library, let it do its matching thing, and that will get you past Apple's restrictions so you can at least upload about 25,000 tracks from your library into iTunes Music Match. And then simply once you've done that, you can go back to your main library and continue to use that as you have normally. If you ever want to change out the tracks, obviously you'll have to do the trick of holding down the Option key and booting back into that library. The other solution that I could think of that I think is not quite as elegant but would work also would be to create a second user account and then set up a library within that and use iTunes Match within that library. But I don't see any reason to do that when you have the prior option that I just mentioned. But those were the two things that I could think of. Maybe some of the clever MacCast listeners out there will have another suggestion for us. I think the long-term hope is that Apple will work out maybe some of these early issues. You know, I think it's going to get better. I think the first thing that I want to see personally would be true streaming on our iOS devices. Sounds like for someone like you, it'd be kind of lifting the 25,000 track limit. And I'm sure we all have our little issues or quirks with iTunes Match. But again, I'm hoping it's just an early day growing pains thing, and then Apple will take our feedback like they often do, take it to heart and continue to improve the service. I think out of the gate, you know, it's hard. I don't want to get too negative on it because I think there are some nice features in there, like I mentioned, but probably not for everybody right on day one. You're going to have to struggle through some of the little quirks and bumps in the roads and just that general clunkiness that I mentioned. And kind of while we're on the subject of not just iTunes music, but just media in general. You know, these days, most of Apple's applications are using libraries. iPhoto, iTunes, Aperture, they all have this sort of central repository, this library that stores the media. And more, inevitably, I'm getting asked about the idea of the ability of multiple members of a family, either on their own Macs, multiple Macs, or on a single Mac, wanting to kind of share a single library rather than each person kind of having their own library of media content. Everybody wants to kind of bring them together. There are a lot of questions like this one from Matt.
Hi, Adam. This is Matt in Dallas, Texas. I had a question for you and the listeners about setting up a home media server, and specifically a photo server. We have an older MacBook Pro in our lineup, and our Pro at a Mac hard drive size on my current MacBook Pro, and my wife is a photo maniac, so we have tons of photos, and I'm just trying to figure out a way that those could be stored, whether it be on a time capsule or some other remote drive, and it acts as a server, and above all, is a seamless experience that whatever machine we're on, we're able to just open up any photo program, whether it be iPhoto, Picasa, like Google, or something else, look at the photos, manipulate the photos, do that sort of stuff, but then not worry about them taking up hard drive space on the actual laptop. Any suggestions you have would be greatly appreciated. Keep up the great work. Really appreciate the show.
Hey, Matt. So, yeah, I get a lot of people asking about stuff like this. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about just the core concepts behind this. And just, it's one of those areas where I felt that Apple really needs to provide some solution at some point. It's becoming more and more common. But I want to talk about why it's tricky and cover these core concepts of what you need to do to set it up. I don't want to get into specifics because there's a lots of different ways to handle doing this, and I think there's lots of gotchas. So in general, I don't recommend that people set this up because generally it leads down a path of confusion. There is no Apple way. You know, Apple is this world of being this happy land with unicorns and ponies. And a long time ago, I learned acceptance of sort of what I call the Apple way. You know, if you just have your account and you have your library and you let iPhoto manage your photos and iTunes manage your music and Aperture manage its photos, everything just works. It's great. You don't have to mess with it. There's not any problems. Apple's walled garden is generally this safe place. And the reason it can be safe is they control all the variables and they can test against known variables. They provide sort of this optimal user experience for the majority of users. It's kind of hitting everybody that is going to have a certain need, or the majority of people that have a certain need, and creating an experience that's seamless and just works. Well, it doesn't work in all cases or scenarios, but most of the time it does. And anytime you start to sort of venture out of those walls, it can be done, but Apple pretty much says, go outside our little walled garden and you're on your own. We really can't protect you out here. So in getting back to this idea of the concept of how to share libraries, the very first thing that you need to do is kind of move the library into an area, shared location, and that, as you were talking about, could be a network drive. It could be on a single Mac. If you have a single Mac, it gets a little bit easier. You can use the shared folder that's in the users folder. That's a good place because of permissions, as we'll get to here in a minute. Another option is to use an external volume on an existing Mac or a network volume. And if you're going to do that, you probably, especially when it's a single volume or a volume external drive that's connected to an existing Mac, make sure you go into the get info for that drive, and you probably want to ignore permissions. Make sure ignore permissions is turned on that drive. And so you move your libraries to kind of this shared location, and then once you've done that, permissions becomes an issue. You need to ensure that all of your users have access to that drive, and all of the users on that drive or on that volume that has the library, I guess the library is really what you need to make sure that everybody has access to. You need to ensure that everybody has read-write permissions to all the files and folders that are contained within that library. Now, in the case of iPhoto, it kind of becomes easy because the iPhoto library really now exists or looks like a single file. And I believe that the permissions cascade down into that. iTunes is a little bit tricky or trickier because, especially with the music files, they're just all contained within a folder. And whichever account adds those files to that directory or that folder ends up kind of being the owner of that. So again, permissions becomes one of these really tricky areas that's now sort of moved out of Apple's control when you have multiple users all accessing the same library. And so once you've got everything in a central location, you've made sure that all of your users have access to it, then what you need to do is point each of the applications for each account at that shared library. In iPhoto and in iTunes, as I mentioned kind of earlier, you can use the trick where you hold down the Option key when launching the application, and then it will ask you to choose your library, so then you can just go out and find that shared location and point that library, point it at that library. In the case of iTunes, once again, it gets tricky because every user account has their own library XML file, sort of metadata file, and you're going to need to centralize that information also. Otherwise, things like play counts and other sorts of things are going to get out of sync. You're going to have someone who maybe adds something to the library. If those files aren't centralized, that library information is not going to sync up. And so you might go to add some new music under your account. Your wife pulls up her account that's pointed at the same actual music files, but she doesn't have any of the updated data in her iTunes library. So you need to make sure that you consolidate everything and point everybody at the same library folder and also metadata information, the iTunes library.xml file. So you can see how things start to get really complicated really, really fast. And so when we talk about leaving the walled garden, it sounds exciting, it sounds fun, it sounds liberating, but there's also these risks and challenges that we have to deal with also. You know, another thing to think about is once you start sharing in this way, everything is shared. You don't have this ability to kind of separate that metadata. So things like playlists, play counts, podcast subscriptions, which is a big one if you're sharing an iTunes library, metadata, albums, your ratings, all that sort of stuff is now centralized and shared. Your application preferences remain separate, but all of that other information gets kind of lumped together. Luckily, devices themselves kind of control the content that you sync to them along with the preferences. So you'll maybe have all the same podcast subscriptions, but you could go in and define for your devices which podcasts actually sync over to your device, but they're all going to be pulling out of a central library. So, you know, you're going to have to see all the podcasts that your wife subscribes to on iTunes. You're going to have to see all of hers if you're doing the iTunes sharing. On the iPhoto side, if she creates a new album for her stuff, you're going to also have that album in your library. You also, again, need to watch out for permissions. You need to make sure that all users always have read-write permissions, and sometimes that can pop up where someone's created a new album and suddenly you can't edit anything within that album, or you can't add items to it because the permissions somehow got set to just that user. So you're going to have an understanding of how to set and change and modify permissions. But sort of once you've done that in the initial setup, it should remain, those permissions should remain set. As I mentioned earlier, if you use the user's shared folder in the situation where you have multiple users on a single Mac, kind of everybody has read-write access to that folder by default. And if you're using external volumes, if you check the ignore permissions checkbox, that should mean that you shouldn't run into some of those issues, but just something to be aware of. You also need to make sure that you avoid situations, especially if you're using a network drive, where multiple users are accessing the library at the same time. So if you had this network volume, you have iPhoto open, your wife has iPhoto open, and you're making changes at the same time, one person's data or changes could overwrite the other person's changes, and you suddenly have this really weird mismatch. So you create an album and your wife creates an album at the same time or makes changes to an album, and your changes overwrite her changes, and you suddenly don't understand why everything's not in sync anymore. And then just to pile on everything, you know, Apple has added a bunch of cloud services, photo streaming, the iTunes or iPhoto photo stream. I'm not sure what happens when you start to bring the cloud into the mix. Another thing to think about is there's a lot of third-party apps and applications that assume things about the structure of your library folders and the integration with iPhoto. You can run into some issues there. So absolutely, anything you do to kind of deviate from the norm can end up really complicating your troubleshooting. So you start to have issues with an application, suddenly it can't find or connect to your iPhoto library, and you're not really sure why. It could have something to do with you moving its location or trying to share the library. So this gets back to my thing where a long time ago, I just decided, you know what, I'm going to accept the Apple way. I'm not going to break outside of the walled garden because I don't want to run into some of these problems. I'm not saying that you can't do it. There are lots of tutorials online. If you do some Googling on how to share iTunes libraries or how to share iPhoto libraries, there's a lot of really great information and sort of step-by-step tutorials. It's really too much for me to go into for every kind of scenario in just the podcast, but you can find that information. I just wanted to make everybody aware of sort of the issues that you're going to run into. I think this gives you a good idea of what you're up against and maybe some of the steps you can go through to kind of share that library. But once you go down that path, just be aware you're kind of outside of Apple's realm. They really don't support it. And I guess the closing thing that I'd like to mention, and I've talked about this in the past, is my hope is that Apple will recognize at some point that there are many of us out there. And believe me, this is something that I would love to do in my own family, sort of have a music photo server that's a centralized thing for my house that everybody can tap into. The thing about it is I think that everybody also wants to be able to maintain their own playlists and play counts and metadata, and that's a solution that Apple's ultimately going to have to provide, this sort of centralized hub, this media Macintosh or server that we might be able to just simply plug into AirPort, and boom, we have this great media server that can kind of contain all of our content. Maybe that's the thing that syncs up with iCloud, and we have kind of the perfect world, but they haven't delivered that to us yet. I think everybody's looking for this holy grail of a solution, and Apple seems like a company that could pull it off. Why they haven't done that yet is beyond me, but we can always hope, right? Hopefully Apple will bring the land of unicorns and ponies over to our iTunes and media sharing. I don't know. I think maybe I'm starting to sound like I'm a little bit of a sourpuss when it comes to this cloud stuff, but you know, there continues to be some issues. You know, this next thing I have to talk about, another cloud thing. Kevin emailed me to talk a little bit about Documents in the Cloud, a new feature that's in iCloud. He was having trouble with his Pages 08 documents as he added those documents to Documents in the Cloud, which, by the way, you have to do through the web interface. If you're on your Mac and you want to put a document into Documents in the Cloud for Pages, say, on the iPhone or just actually any iWork application on your iOS device, you need to go to iCloud.com, log in, and then you can add files through there, and that will upload them. So what he was doing was putting in these Pages 08 documents, and come to find out when he would open up Pages on his iOS device, the documents weren't there. They weren't supported. Actually, only iWork 09 files are supported by the current generation iOS applications. Now, luckily, it's pretty easy to convert them. To convert, you need to make sure that you have the latest version of iWork applications on your Mac and then open them up and then just simply save them. It will actually warn you that you're going to lose backward compatibility with the iWork 08 applications. You can get that back after saving them out as iWork 09 documents by going in and doing a duplicate. What used to be a save as, if you're running Lion, you go ahead and you say file duplicate to duplicate the 09 document, and then choose file save. And when you're doing the save, you put in the name, and then you'll see a little checkbox that says save copy as. You check that, and then in that dropdown is an option to save it back out as an iWork 08 document. So if you need to roll back your format. But if you want to get them up into documents in the cloud and you want to support them on your iOS devices, you are going to have to convert your current 08 documents into the 09 format. But here again is just another one of these areas where Apple's implementation of a cloud service is a little bit clunky, a little bit kludgy, because, you know, on iOS devices, documents in the cloud works pretty great. If I save a document in Pages on my iPad, for example, and then I just go ahead and open that up, and I'm using documents in the cloud, open that up on my iPhone, it will sync up and that document will be available to me. If I want to get that document on my Mac, unfortunately right now, Apple didn't put an update for its iWork applications. So the way it has to work is I have to use the web interface, log in with Safari with my browser, and actually pull down a copy of that document, work on it, and then if I want to save it back out, if I save it to my Mac, it's not going to go back up into the cloud. I actually have to go back to the web interface and re-upload it. Now, there actually is a little trick, and a lot of people have discovered that there's actually a folder on your Mac that's already syncing up your documents in the cloud documents. If you go into your home folder, into the library folder, there's a folder called Mobile Documents, and inside there, there is a folder for each one of your iWork applications. So it'll be something like com, tilde, Apple, tilde, Pages. And then within there, there's a documents folder, and that has all of the documents that you sync through documents in the cloud. And you can even upload documents. If you take a Pages document or an iWork document and put it in the appropriate folder within that mobile documents folder, it will actually upload it up into documents in the cloud. Now, the weird thing about it is once it's done that, it sort of converts it into this special folder structure, and you can no longer upload it in your desktop app. But you can use that rather than going through the web interface to kind of force a document to go up into documents in the cloud. Not really sure how useful it is because you can't back out of it on the desktop, but it is there, and just a trick that I wanted to point out to you. Once again, though, it's been converted, and now you can open it up in your iOS devices. It'll be there, but if you need to get it back onto your Mac, you have to go back through the iCloud.com web interface. Again, this is something that I'm hoping, because iCloud is a new service and Apple's been working on it, that we'll have an update to the iWork applications on the Mac, and it'll be integrated. I'm sure Apple has plans for that. If not, I really don't know what they're doing with their cloud services. But it almost feels like they shouldn't have rolled some of this stuff out, because, again, none of this really feels like the Apple way of doing things. It's not just simple for the average user. You know, even guys like myself, I'm pretty technical. I consider myself pretty geeky with a Mac, and I think many of you do too. We're having to sort of work our way through this stuff and figure it out, and figure out these little tips and tricks and kind of hidden things. And that's just not the way it should be. So Apple needs to really get their cloud strategy, I think, together and get more in line with their desktop iOS philosophy of it just works. Now I have a question that came from Ernesto. Ernesto has a friend who owns an iPhone 3GS and wanted to be able to save voicemails off of the device. The thing is that this friend is using a PC and not a Mac. So I had an answer for someone who's using a Mac. Actually, on the Mac, I use a piece of software called PhoneView from Ecamm. This is a really cool application. It allows you to browse your iOS device and actually copy off or even add files directly to the device. So you can actually use the software to kind of use your iPhone or your iOS device as a portable disk drive as well. It has a bunch of features. It cannot access the iOS files folder, which is kind of this special folder that you can see on your Mac. If you want to do that, There's another piece of software called iExplorer that allows you to get into that. But that one did not have a way to save off voicemails without doing a jailbreak. So two different applications that kind of do similar things. With the eCam software, it gives you direct access to your contacts, your notes, your call logs, your SMS messages or your messages, so you can actually save that history off. You can get access to your web history and your bookmarks, the voicemails, of course, and also third-party application data. So if you need to save off, you know, like high score data from a game or something like that, you can use this application to get that off, back it up, and maybe even load it back on if you're doing something like a restore of your device and then setting it up as a new device, which is sometimes something you need to do when you're troubleshooting. So it's really great for that. It also gives you access to all of your media, so your music, your videos, your books, your podcasts, ringtones, photos, and your voice memos. You can all directly access from the eCam software. And so when Ernesto was asking me about a similar application for the PC, I decided to go check the eCam site, a support site, and see if they maybe had a recommendation. They actually did. They recommend a program from a company called Wide Angle Software that offers similar functionality on the PC called CopyTouch. So I'll have a link both to eCam and the Wide Angle Software in the show notes at maccast.com. Ernesto, I hope that helps your friend out. I can't vouch for the software because I've never tried it on the PC side, but it sounds like something that would work. I'm sure maybe there's also some members of the MacCast community who might have additional recommendations. So if you send those to me, I'll make sure they get forwarded on to Ernesto. Have another MacCast listener who could use a little bit of help. Something that I hadn't even noticed in the latest versions of the iWork applications on iOS devices. Javier pointed out that they now no longer have the tab key up in the ruler. This is specifically for Pages, I believe. Used to be that if you were working in the Pages application on your iOS device, it has that little drop-down ruler, and there was a simple key that you could push to put a tab into your document that you were working on. That key is no longer there. They've replaced it with the little pop-up, so when you tap and need to do like a selection, it gives you that little kind of black pop-up menu bar that comes up contextually. You now have to tap that, bring up that contextual selection pop-up. Then there's a little arrow key, a sort of right arrow key on the end of that. You tap that. That gives you more options. Then there's an insert option. You tap that, and then that pops up a little list, and the tab is in there. So it takes literally four taps to insert a tab into your document as opposed to just the one tap from the ruler that you used to be able to do. There is no simple tab on the keyboard, although I have noticed on the virtual keyboard, sort of right there on the left side, there's a nice little space that could fit sort of a half key that could be a tab key very easily. I'm not sure why Apple wouldn't do that. There also doesn't appear to be any way to actually customize the keyboard or any of the controls within the iWork applications, unless I'm missing some sort of trick, which is why I'm throwing it out to all of you. If there is a trick for more quickly and easily accessing a tab key in the latest version of the iWork applications on iOS, please let us know. Javier, for your issue, the only thing I could think of would be to use some sort of alternative, maybe use another application that has a tab key. I have a great text editor called Textastic that I like to use, and in that application, they actually have a whole row of keys right above the standard keyboard, and a tab is one of those. I also use Nebulous Notes, which I believe also has quick access to a tab key. So you could use one of those applications to write your text and then either copy and paste it from that application into Pages on your iOS device, or use the Open In option to send your text document back into Pages and then continue to work on it from there, adding in any of your formatting and page layout stuff that you normally would do in the Pages application. You could also look at maybe using a third-party outlining application, something like Omni Outliner from the Omni Group or Circus Pony's Notebook, and that could be the way that you do your outlining. Again, you're going to have to buy another application, so maybe you don't want to do that. Maybe you're happy with using Pages. But those are just some of the options that I can think of, unless someone in the community has an additional suggestion, and hopefully they will, and we'll cover that on a future episode of the MacCast. I guess since we've been talking a lot about cloud stuff, I should finish out with one more little cloud thing. Of course, it's it's someone who's having an issue with one of the new cloud services, and that's the PhotoStream. This has actually been one of the new services that I've been pretty happy with, has been working pretty well for me. Unfortunately, it hasn't seemed to have gone as well for Bruce.
Hey there, Adam. I just listened to your most recent show and wanted to make some comments on the PhotoStream. I know you're having a really good experience with it, but that hasn't been my experience. There's been a couple times I've been out and about taking pictures. I come home, open up iPhoto, and let's say I took 45 pictures out about town, and when I turn on iPhoto, look in the photo stream there, only like 10 of the pictures are showing up in the photo stream. And I'm like, that's kind of weird. So I'm kind of like, maybe it has to be on the Wi-Fi network for a while. So I'm just kind of leaving the phone on, leaving the iPhoto open, and the pictures don't ever go over. It just stays at the 10. And I can't figure out why some are going over and some are not. So I actually have to tether my phone, and of course then all the pictures do come over. So it's just not working. That's happened to me 3 times now. And that combined with the fact that once they're in the photo stream, even on the iOS device, you can't move them into a photo album or tag them in any kind of way. They're just there. It's not proving that useful for me. It seems it's just for a way to view all the pictures you've recently taken on all your devices, but you can't actually do anything with them until you open iPhoto, put them into album, and then tether your device. So it seems to be like a halfway solution. I mean, it's good that when you take a picture with your phone, it shows up on your Mac, but without being able to move it into a photo album or something, I decided to turn the photo stream off. So, glad it's working for you, but I don't know if anyone else is having those issues that not all the pictures are coming over. Maybe you know why some pictures are going over and some are not. There was one time I was at my house for, you know, an hour or two. The pictures weren't going over. Went over to a friend's house, checked it over there, like, and after I was there for an hour, and on their Wi-Fi, a couple of the pictures wound up coming through. I was watching them pop up in the photo stream, which I thought was really weird. It was popping up when I was on their Wi-Fi, but it wasn't popping up on my own Wi-Fi. So I don't know what that was about. Anyway, so just some odd things with photo stream. Hopefully they work the kinks out, and it gets better as time goes on, because I really think it would be great. I just think that it's not there yet. So anyway, I just want to leave those comments, and want to hear what you have to say before PhotoStream. Talk to you soon, and anxious to keep on listening to more shows.
Hey, Bruce, thanks for the comment. Yeah, I mean, PhotoStream has been a little bit quirky for me as well. I don't want to give the impression that it has been smooth sailing or perfect. And I think, again, going back to this is a new service for Apple, I think there's some situations where the servers are a little slow, where it's a little bit taxed. I don't know specifically when you were trying it, if it was early on, but it seems to be performing better and better for me. There is a delay sometimes when I open up iPhoto. It can take a little bit of time for certain photos to come in. I've noticed some will come in quickly, and then it'll kind of stop, and then I wait a 30 seconds, a minute, and then more start to come in. I do want to address your issue on your iOS devices with actually creating albums out of the photo stream. That should be working. If you're running iOS 5, they do now have the ability, using the little action button, if you go into the photo stream and you click the little button that, you know, looks like a square with a little arrow kind of pointing out of it, that's the little action button. If you tap that and turn it on, it gives you the ability to select photos in your photo stream by simply tapping them. And then down along the bottom, you have the share copy menu. You also now have an add to button and a save button. If you hit the save button, it'll save them into your main library. If you, again, tap that little action button, do the selection and hit add to, it gives you the ability to add those items to an existing album or create a new album with those items in it. So I don't know if maybe you just missed that one. It is a new feature, something that came in iOS 5. So just wanted to make you aware of that. I don't know if that's going to help with your syncing issues. You know, with the Wi-Fi thing, being at your friend's house, I have a feeling that maybe it was just a case where you tried it at home. They were having some server issues on the Apple end, and then when you got over there, things were kind of fixed up and resolved. So I would continue to use the service. I don't know if you need to turn it off. When it works, it works great. And when it's not working, I think, you know, it's probably just some of those bumps in the road and a little bit of growing pains. And I think Apple's going to work through those. So I think that should be the kind of way to close this out. I know I've kind of bagged on some of the cloud services, or it seems like I've been a little bit negative on them. I'm actually very positive about what Apple's doing with iCloud. I think there's some good services here. There's some good foundation. I think they just need to make the processes a little bit smoother and a little bit easier for non-technical users to figure out and kind of, you know, just have the stuff just work like it really should. And I think we'll get there. I think it's just taking a little bit longer than some of us would really have hoped. And especially since Apple's had a few years with MobileMe and .Mac, we were, you know, there were high hopes for iCloud. And I think they didn't realize those. But I think we will get there. So I want to end kind of on that positive thought. And that's going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their products, get more information and details over at Pharonix.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, get information on their software as well as free trials over at CircusPonies.com. Smile, check out PDF Pen, Disk Label, Text Expander, great software. You can get trials, more information, and details over at SmileSoftware.com. And Gazelle, great place to get cash for your old electronics. Get more information, do a search over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Keep your emails, your audio comments coming. Love hearing from you, and would like to know what you'd like to hear covered on future episodes of the MacCast. You can send your emails to maccast@gmail.com. Also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. And if you leave a voicemail, if you could leave your email address, that's greatly appreciated. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you'd like to visit the MacCast.com website, there you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. Great community of MacCast listeners. You can hang out, ask questions, and get help with your Mac issues between shows. And also between shows, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. And there, Twitter and Facebook, I like to just post cool, interesting things, articles. As I'm doing research, I might find a cool video, something like that, that I want to share with you. The Facebook page or on Twitter is a great place to catch up on that sort of stuff. So if you're wondering what kinds of things that I post there, that's why you might want to follow me. And Twitter, I think I'm getting very close to 10,000 followers. So if you'd like to help push me over that 10,000 follower limit, please follow me on Twitter if you haven't done so already. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.